News.
Two Iranian intelligence organizations say that undeniable evidence shows U.S. masterminded recent riots in the country. People across Iran take to the streets to condemn Wednesday's terrorist attack on a southern shrine that left 13 people dead. And Russia announces an end of mobilization of 300,000 reservists to fight in Ukraine. Hello, everyone. Thanks for tuning in to World News. Iran says it is in possession of irrefutable documents proving the U.S. was the chief architect of recent riots in the country. In a statement, Iran's intelligence ministry and the intelligence organization of the IRGC said the U.K., Israeli, and Saudi spy agencies also colluded in the plot. The statement added that the plans were hatched prior to the riots to create a nationwide crisis in the country. The ultimate aim of the plot was to commit crimes against the Iranian nation, violate Iran's territorial integrity, and paved the way for further foreign pressure against the country. The two Iranian intelligence organizations also said, despite claims of the current U.S. administration, it is continuing and even intensifying the so-called maximum pressure campaign against Iran. The statement said the U.S. is also targeting the social fabric of Iran by trying to polarize the nation. Political commentator Mohammad Ali Araki tells us how the U.S. and its allies foment unrest to overthrow governments that do not toe their line.
The statement that has been issued by the Islamic Republic of Iran officials is a very precise and clear statement. The United States of America and its allies around the world believe in an idea called organic uprisings. Now, it's not as honest as it looks, organic uprisings. What they want to do is they look to overthrow governments that are not in line with their benefits. And the Islamic Republic of Iran and its allies in the Middle East and around the world are an example of those governments. So therefore, what they do is they try to start protests that when you look at it from outside, when you zoom back, it looks like, yes, there are people here, they disagree with their government. But in fact, the reality is that the United States of America and all the intelligence services that they are working closely with, they are the ones behind this. And this can clearly be seen in the events that started from Mahsa Amini ongoing to the recent terrorist attacks that occurred in Shiraz. And it is important for me to mention that these will not end here. They will keep on trying, but they will fail in the end, and they will not reach the target that they wish to reach.
Iranians from all walks of life have taken to the streets to condemn the terror attack in the southern city of Shiraz, which left 13 people dead and dozens injured, Salman Khujuri reports.
Iranians have held nationwide rallies to condemn the Wednesday terrorist attack in the southern city of Shiraz. The protesters took to the streets in different cities following Friday prayers. They chanted slogans and held banners, calling for the perpetrators and their backers to be brought to justice.
Today, we're here to show the world that we are all together. We are a powerful country. We're going to fight against terrorism. We're going to fight against violence. You want us to be separated. You want us to fight against each other, but we are the one. We are powerful.
At least 13 people, including two children, were killed after gunmen opened fire on pilgrims at the Shah Charagh Holy Shrine in Shiraz. 26 others were wounded. The Daesh terror group claimed responsibility shortly after the attack.
We strongly condemn any acts of terrorism and desecration of Muslim sanctities. We want to say that we hate London-based news channels like Iran International, Manoto, and BBC because they are instigating violence and unrest in Iran.
We are here to send this message to Israel, the U.S., and their allies that through creating riots and unrest in the country, they cannot achieve their sinister goal of disintegration of Iran. We are united.
Leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, has called on security agencies, the judiciary, intellectuals, activists, and the entire nation to act in unison to confront the current which is disregarding and disrespecting people's lives, security, and sanctities. Meanwhile, Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi has also vowed that the Islamic Republic would deliver a crushing response to those who were behind the bloodshed.
The ralliers have called on Iranian authorities to prosecute the main perpetrators of the heinous crime of terrorist attack in Shiraz and take all necessary measures to maintain security in the country as soon as possible. Salman Khujuri, Tehran.
And political commentator Fuad Izadi tells us why meddlesome U.S. policies will once again fail in Iran.
Intelligence services have infiltrated ISIS and ISIS-linked groups for many, many years. And they utilize these groups to achieve foreign policy goals. You know, the terrorist attack in Shiraz happened on the 40th day of passing of Mahsa Amini. So this is a way of showing support for the riots in Iran. But this is a terrorist organization. So you know, instead of just issuing a statement, they engage in some sort of terrorist activity, killing 15 innocent people at the shrine. So overall, I think when these type of things happen, Iranians realize what's going on. Majority of people in Iran are used to this type of American scheme. They know all about color revolution and the different tactics that Americans use to orchestrate color revolution. And this is going to backfire. And what you see in demonstrations today is basically the backfire that is expected from the Iranian people. And so the Americans are going to fail once again when it comes to their Iran policy.
Iran says U.S. sanctions have prevented its imports of food and medicine. Now, Iran says this is against a ruling by the International Court of Justice mandating that Washington exempts food and medicine from bans. Iran's Deputy U.N. Ambassador Zahra Ershadi said the U.S. has failed to comply with the court order, saying the U.S. has even imposed additional sanctions, openly defying the judgment. Ershadi made the statement while speaking during a United Nations General Assembly debate on the International Court of Justice. U.S. has staged a campaign of maximum pressure against Iran since former President Donald Trump withdrew from the 2015 nuclear deal. Under the policy, Washington reimposed unilateral sanctions, which were removed under the agreement. And joining us now from San Francisco, California, Scott Bennett, political commentator, for more on the story. Hello, Scott. I hope you're safe and doing well. We've talked about this before, Scott. Iran keeps bringing it up, but it doesn't really get addressed, right? It's against international law. It's against UN Charter to use food or medicine, to actually have sanctions applied to food or medicine, or ever use them in rules of engagement, rules of war. They're supposed to be off limits. What's going on, Scott?
Well, it is a crime against humanity. It's a crime of genocide. It's a weapon of genocide. Of course, this shouldn't surprise us, first of all, from the political leadership of a country that has killed hundreds of thousands of Iraqi children under Madeleine Albright, that has killed children in, of course, the Iraq-Iran war with the chemical weapons that the United States supplied to Iraq. And now we see the United States also killing the children and elderly senior citizen people in Ukraine by empowering the fanatical maniacs of the woke left in the Nazi tattooed uniform of Zelensky's regime to bomb and engage in genocide. So it shouldn't surprise us that there's no moral restraint or sanity or decency in the Western hegemonic obsessionists in the political and military class. This should, of course, be brought up to the entire world community and the entire United Nations and the entire world criminal court, and it should be demanded that sanctions against the United States are imposed for this crime of genocide, this crime against humanity, and immediate requests for all nations who value the lives of children and value the common human decency of providing food and medicine to those who need it. This defines a truly civilized human being, and those who are against the provision of medicine and food defines a demoniac lunatic that's unworthy of life.
All right, good stuff. Stay safe. Always a pleasure, Scott. Talk to you soon from San Francisco, California. Scott Bennett there joining us. Meanwhile, Iran's foreign minister once again dismisses allegations that it has provided drones to Russia to use in the war against Ukraine. Hossein Amir Abdollahian says Tehran's policy regarding the war in Ukraine is a refrain from sending weapons to warring parties. He made the comments in a phone call with his Ukrainian counterpart. The foreign minister also said that Tehran respects the territorial integrity of countries and seeks the cessation of the war and the displacement of people. He called for Ukrainian officials to avoid the influence of some extremist European politicians. Abdullahian also expressed Iran's readiness to hold technical meetings with Ukrainian military experts on the issue of drones. For his part, Dmitry Kuleba welcomed Iran's stance and highlighted the importance of technical military talks between the two countries. Now, after more than a decade of on and off indirect talks, Lebanon and Israel have signed a U.S.-mediated deal to end their maritime dispute. Now, the agreement will allow Lebanon to exploit its own natural resources, and our correspondent, Mariam Saleh, has your details.
Lebanon and Israel have finalized a U.S.-brokered deal aimed at resolving a maritime dispute. President Michel Aoun signed a letter on Thursday endorsing the agreement. The final paperwork was submitted to the United Nations in Naqoura, southern Lebanon, concluding a long path of indirect negotiations with the Israeli regime. Separately, the Israeli cabinet, led by Prime Minister Yair Lapid, also approved the agreement. The regime's representative then delivered the signed copy to the UN at the Naqoura point. Hezbollah Secretary General stressed in a brief statement that the deal is a victory for Lebanon's government, people, and resistance. Nasrallah also declared the end of Hezbollah's exceptional mobilization over the maritime dispute, saying the resistance movement had accomplished its mission regarding the issue. The Hezbollah leader said the agreement is not an international treaty.
What happened in Naqoura is not normalization with Israel. This deal is not an international treaty and is not a recognition of Israel. Israel itself has admitted it received no security guarantees.
U.S. Envoy Amos Hochstein, who was with the Lebanese delegation in the southern Lebanese town of Naqoura, had met the top Lebanese officials.
I truly believe and hope that this can be an economic turning point in Lebanon for a new era of investment and continued support to lift up the economy and make sure that whatever arrangements happen, they're done openly, transparently, and making sure that the benefits are felt directly by all the Lebanese people.
Experts believe this agreement would put Lebanon on the map of natural gas exporters. President Michel Aoun stressed in his statement that demarcating the southern maritime border is a technical matter that has no political implications and won't change his country's policy towards the Israeli regime. U.S. President Joe Biden has hailed the maritime border deal as a historic breakthrough. For Lebanon, it unlocks the possibility to exploit its own natural resources at a time when the West is seeking gas suppliers and looking for alternatives to Russian gas. Maryam Saleh, Naqoura, South Lebanon.
Russia's defense minister says partial mobilization of 300,000 reservists to fight in Ukraine is now complete. Sergei Shoigu says over a quarter of the draftees have been deployed to the battlefield. He stressed that no additional mobilization has been planned for the time being. And this is the first one of its kind with reservists by Russia since World War II. The Russian president ordered the call-up in September after he approved the annexation of four eastern and southern Ukrainian regions. The Ukrainian president, Volodymyr Zelensky, has expressed doubt that the call-up is finished. He says Moscow may need to send new soldiers to the conflict very soon. Ukraine and NATO countries continue to claim Crimea as part of Ukraine, despite a referendum there on joining Russia in 2014. Johnny Miller reports.
The elegant streets of historic Sevastopol. Ukraine and NATO still claim this city and the rest of Crimea as part of Ukraine, despite the 2014 referendum on joining Russia. Down by the harbour, I wanted to know how people feel about Ukrainian threats of taking back this city.
Crimea is not baggage to transfer in and out. People don't want to return to Ukraine, and they never identified as Ukrainian.
I don't want Crimea to return to Ukraine. We are Russian. We speak Russian. We were raised as Russian, and we have Russian culture. I was born in 1986, and never in my life did I feel myself Ukrainian. I have Ukrainian citizenship, but all my life I considered myself Russian and living in a Russian city.
My personal opinion was Crimea was Russian and remains Russia. I'm an ordinary man and this is my opinion. It will be bad if someone wants to take away Crimea. But I'm against the war that is going on. It's terrible what is going on in my beloved Russia.
A Russian fighter jet flies overhead, a common occurrence, perhaps returning from a combat mission in Kherson. Sometimes cruise missiles can be seen from the harbour, fired by Russia's Black Sea Fleet, which is based in the city.
Let them dream. It's not harmful to dream. We are at home. Nobody asked our opinion when Crimea became part of Ukraine. We were forced to become Ukrainian citizens. 30 years later, we returned home. We were tormented and were worried. Ukrainians were treating us badly. Everyone here is Russian.
Soviet leader Nikita Khrushchev gave Crimea to Ukraine in 1954. Many see that as a historic mistake, not reflective of the wishes of locals.
Now, I have found a couple of people who are more pro-Ukrainian. They don't want to say their views openly, and they do tend to be from a younger demographic born after the fall of the Soviet Union. But even amongst that age group, they are very much in the minority.
So Ukraine and NATO say that they want to take back Crimea from Russia. How do you feel about that?
I wish you good luck. Let's try. They can try, but they won't at all. It's a Russian place. What can I say more?
So we are Russians.
While Russia and Ukraine continue to claim this city as their own, one thing is not in doubt. The vast majority of people living here want to be part of the Russian Federation. Chernomil, Sevastopol, Crimea.
Thanks for tuning in, and goodbye for now.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight. In Britain, the new Prime Minister Rishi Sunak has vowed to bring integrity to No. 10 Downing Street. The new Prime Minister has pledged to fix mistakes of his predecessor, but return of a former Home Secretary has alarmed some MPs in the House of Commons. We take a look at some of the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The British newspaper The Guardian has more on this story. The new Prime Minister Rishi Sunak has pledged to bring integrity and accountability as Prime Minister on his first day at No. 10, but gambled by restoring Suella Braverman to the Home Office less than a week after she was forced to resign for a security breach. In a reshuffle billed as returning experienced hands to the top jobs, Rishi Sunak also risks alienating backers of his leadership rival, Penny Mordaunt, for dashing her hopes of promotion and leaving her with no option but to stay in a minor role. As he entered No. 10 Downing Street as Prime Minister, the fifth in 6 years, Sunak said his government vowed to fix the mistakes of his predecessor, Liz Truss, and warned of difficult decisions to come. His first cabinet reshuffle attempted to maintain financial stability by keeping Jeremy Hunt as Chancellor of the Exchequer and bridge the divide with former Prime Minister Boris Johnson and his supporters by sticking with the Foreign Secretary James Cleverly and the Defence Secretary Ben Wallace. He installed Dominic Raab, his own key ally, who described Truss's economics as a suicide note, as his Deputy Prime Minister and Justice Secretary. However, Rishi Sunak made several decisions that have surprised and even alarmed some MPs, as he reappointed Suella Braverman as Home Secretary and declined to promote his former rival, Penny Mordaunt. He also appointed David Davis as Welsh Secretary, despite his controversial comments on subjects including face veils, child refugees, climate change. Suella Braverman, who still harbours her own leadership ambitions, was handed the job 6 days after she was forced to resign for a security breach for emailing confidential policy to a backbench MP, John Hayes, and trying to copy in his wife, but mistakenly emailing it to another MP's office. Officials raised the alarm that Braverman may have been sharing sensitive information outside the department. The return of Suella Braverman, a Eurosceptic right-winger, drew a shocked reaction from some MPs on the moderate wing of the Conservative Party, but is widely seen as a payback for her endorsement of Rishi Sunak when Boris Johnson still threatened a comeback during the leadership race last week. Sky News Australia has more on the same story. The new British Prime Minister, Rishi Sunak, has vowed to bring integrity and humility to No. 10 Downing Street, but warned Conservative Party must unite or die. The newly elected British Prime Minister, Rishi Sunak, declared in his first remarks that Britain needs stability and unity, adding he will do his best to bring the country together as it navigates a profound economic challenge. Rishi Sunak will be the United Kingdom's 57th Prime Minister after he was elected unopposed as the Conservative Party leader. The new Prime Minister will meet King Charles III on Tuesday at Buckingham Palace. He will there be invited to form a new government before he travels to No. 10 Downing Street, where he will make his first official statement as Prime Minister of Britain.
Back to reality.
It's the show where we discuss the most topical of topics, the most controversial of controversies, and the most important affairs of affairs.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, everyone. This is IRB English Radio. You're listening to Back to Reality. Well, this is Asma. I have the honor to be your host for today's episode, and here with me I have two very dear guests, Sister Zainab and Sister Bita, and I would love them to introduce themselves.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, Sister Asma, and all the listeners. I'm really happy to be here today. I'm Zainab Sadat, and I have my MA in English Language Teaching, TFL.
So great. And you, Sister Bita?
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. And actually, I have the pleasure to be here today with you too, my dear friends, and also our dear listeners here. It's a big pleasure for me. So I'm Bita, and I'm a medical student at Sheikh Bashir University. And also, I'm here at your service for today's discussion.
Okay. Thank you, both of you, actually. Thank you for being here, and thank you, dear listeners, for being the other side of this discussion. Well, for today, we are going to have something very much interesting. I would like to start it this way. In this world, there are many situations that which people will get to go to wars. And then plenty much of mothers, plenty much of women, children would have to lose their loved ones. These people are going to be either on the right side of the battle or on the wrong side. Leave that wrong side aside, because we're not talking about them. We talk about the right side of a battle in which the warriors, the soldiers, are going to be lost. Now, the death of these people to some nations is pretty much peculiar, you know? They're still, at this age, now that we are living in a modern age, there are plenty much of people who do not know so much about martyrs. They do not give it too much of credit, you know what I mean? They look at it as something pretty much physical. Someone went to a battle, went to a war, and then he's dead. He no longer lives. Yet, we know that in our religion, when we send someone to a war and then they are killed in that battle, we call them martyrs, and they are going to be so valuable and so worthy creatures for us. Shall you please tell me your ideas upon the fact that many people do not actually translate the word martyr as the way we translate it? They call it, it's just a suicide machine. It's not just something pretty much sacred or holy, as we call it.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, I want to tell you actually my translation of this word, martyrdom, actually. There is actually a meaning, a special meaning in our religion for this word, that it tells us martyrdom is a kind of actually losing your life or precious life for a special goal, which has a lot of benefit to other people. And one another thing that I want to tell you is that Islam views a martyr as a man or woman who dies while conducting jihad. You know that. So I think the difference between this word, this precious word of martyr and suicide, is the goal behind them. So if you're going to go through a death of someone and you want to just evaluate it, whether it is, worthy to be called a martyr or not, you have to go through the goal behind this, actually, death. And this is the actual and the important part of this discussion, in my opinion. When you go through something and you're sure to... you are sure that if you lose your life, you will save other people's lives, and you know it will benefit most of the people. This is the meaning of martyrdom, I think. So I was just wanted to clarify the meaning of martyrdom, then just tell my own idea about this topic. You know what? I think there are many people in this world that want to change this world in a way, in a better way, actually, to a more developed world, actually. So everybody will choose a way, no matter which kind of way. Someone wants to change this world by living. When you live and you suffer, and this suffering will somehow benefit other people, this is a way of jihad. And the other part of it is dying, actually. When you die for a special value that you evaluate in your life, it means that you mean something. Your death means something. Mm-hmm. And this exactly. is my opinion about this actually topic.
Now, Sister Bita, you just mentioned jihad. Let's clarify that for the audience. Mm-hmm. If Sister Zainab helps me with that, I would pretty much like that. Well, jihad to us is defined as a war in which a group of people are going to go in the intention of saving other people's lives. And they're going to fight for the truth.
Yes, Sister Asma, that was exactly what I wanted to say. You know, you talked about the one aspect of seeing life as going and participating in war as something quite useless and resembling suicide. Mm-hmm. That might be true. In fact, in general, when you are faithless.
Exactly.
Yes. So when you are faithless, you believe that you come to this world, you are supposed to live your life to the fullest and take advantage of it, and then you will die and you will finish. You will just lose whatever you had. But in case you are a religious person, in case you believe in God, the whole story differs. You are supposed to gather or conduct good deeds, be a good person, in order to go and live in another world, in another life, the hereafter, in peace and happiness. What sets a difference between suicide and martyrdom is the intention behind it.
Exactly.
The person who goes and participates in war has this belief in his or her mind that I'm going for the sake of Allah.
Yeah.
I'm going to participate in the war. I'm leaving my family, my mother, my wife, my
happiness
children.
And prosperity.
Yes, and the most precious thing that a person has is his or her life.
Definitely,
I'm going to give my life for the sake of Allah.
That is very true.
So that is the intention. When you commit suicide, you just are aware that you are putting an end to your life. And in martyrdom, that is just the same, in the same way somehow. You mm-hmm. are aware that you're participating in a war. But the difference, as I said, is just the intention that you have.
Mm-hmm. So, dear listeners, we're talking about martyrdom. We are actually telling, differentiating between martyrdom and the suicide mission that some people would like to attach it to martyrdom. Let's go for a short break and we'll be back after no time.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Back to Reality.
Welcome back, dear listeners. This is Back to Reality. We were talking about martyrdom. We said that up until now, what I got from the guest's point of view, going to a war with the intention that Allah will be satisfied with what I'm doing, and I'm fighting for truth, and I'm doing this because I want plenty much of people to be saved from the actual danger that is heading toward them. This is the intention of martyrdom. And one person, one man, one woman, they are going to sacrifice their own souls for the benefit of other people, other members of their nation. So now we continue the discussion, and let's have more on the differentiation between martyrdom and suicide.
Of course. You know, supporting the beautiful idea of my sister Zainab, I want to tell you that this martyrdom actually is not limited to battlefield. You know, it's so wider and so, you know, vaster than what you think. For example, as you know, the COVID-19 was a disaster that, you know, influenced the lives of most of the people around the world. And one of the impact of this actually virus was the martyrdom of many precious doctors and nurses and medical actually service in the hospitals around the world, not only in Islamic countries or something. There were many doctors around the world, despite their religions, that sacrificed their lives to save other people. And I think this means something actually in this topic. And I want to tell you that when someone commits suicide, it's like, you know, you are numb about anything in this life. You don't have any value, and you want to end your life to just not to take the responsibility of all the burdens in this life. You know what? Mm-hmm. And I think when someone commits suicide, this is the end of selfishness. You have to be so selfish to commit suicide, in my opinion. And this is the opposite.
While the martyrs are just the most selfless people.
Exactly. And this is the opposite point of martyrdom. When you will be a martyr in your life, it means that you sacrifice your life. At the same time, you know that how precious your life is.
Yeah.
And at the same time, you want to sacrifice it to save other people. And this means actually the pure kindness in human beings. And
selflessness, devotion, kindness, whatever, and that is all related to humanity, you know?
Yeah.
Because if you do not have that essence in you, the essence of true humanity, then you would never put your life in your hand and go sacrifice it when many people might call it suicide. Yeah. Now, Sister Zainab, what happens? What do you let's sit in the eyes of those who call it suicide. Why do they call it this way?
You know, because I think they don't have the understanding that religion gives a person.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when you are faithless, when you do not believe in religion, and as I said, when you do not believe in the hereafter and the other world, so you are supposed to live your life. So what should you put an end to it? You know, that makes it quite meaningless for them. But, you know, another aspect to view martyrdom is they emphasize that a religion and Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala puts on the concepts of justice and truth and the importance of seeking these concepts for human beings, even at the cost of their lives.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is what gives meaning, putting aside that concept of intention for Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, for God's sake. This beautiful concept of truth and, you know, justice, which is so worthy in our religion, and this concept that we are going and sacrificing our lives for is quite meaningless for those countries who do not have faith. So you can see that it's quite interesting for me, and it's quite deep. You know, it's a deep point of view that exists in Islam, and we should be grateful of it.
Martyrdom is not going to be restricted to battlefields. The thing that differentiates being martyred and being trapped in a suicide machine is the intention and the creed that we have. Because when you do something in the intention that God would be satisfied with what I'm doing, and then I'm saving an entire nation, would change the whole story and turn it into something valuable. So no matter what propagandas will do, no matter what media is going to spread all over the world, no matter how much wrong notions we can see and hear nowadays, there are some men and women who sacrifice their lives for the benefit of other people in order to save an entire nation, in order to save plenty much of people who do not have any relation with them even sometimes. And as Bita just put it, sometimes it happens that a group of people like doctors, like, I don't know, even maybe engineers, if something wrong happens with the cities, then they would have to go and sacrifice their lives for the benefit of others. And I guess that is the core of our existence. That is the core of our being. We do not kill ourselves for the sheer fun of getting killed. Nobody with no true mind or brain would do that. Of course, the one who's getting into those battlefields, into those wars, has got a creed, has got a way of thinking, has got some very much deep beliefs that would take them into sacrificing their life, which is the dearest thing a person can have. So, this was all the time that we had for today's episode. Until another session, I bid you farewell and may Allah shower you with His blessings. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Ya Allah, Ya Rabb al Alameen, Ya Rahman, Ya Rahim, Ya Rabbi. Let the Ummah rise again. Ya Allah, Ya Rabb al-Alameen, Ya Rahman, Ya Rahim, Ya Rabbi. Let the Ummah rise again. Let us see daylight again, once again.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
The U.S. decades-long conflicts around the world has brought nothing for this country and its people except defamation and distrust. The consequences of U.S. disasters are so devastating that the issue of U.S. interventions is discussed almost daily and in every podium. In this regard, we have taken a look at the world media for further details. Stay tuned, please. The website of Common Dreams wrote, Like many other institutions, the U.S. military carries with it the seeds of its own destruction. After all, despite being funded in a fashion beyond compare and spreading its peculiar brand of destruction around the globe, its system of war hasn't triumphed in a significant conflict since the Second World War, with the war in Korea remaining almost three quarters of a century later in a painful and festering stalemate. Even the ending of the Cold War only led to further wanton military adventurism and finally defeat at an unsustainable cost, more than $8 trillion in Washington's ill-fated so-called global war on terror. And yet, years later, that military still has a stranglehold on the national budget. So many defeats, so little honesty. That's the catastrophe we have used to characterize this country's military record since 1945. Keeping the money flowing and the wars going proved far more important than integrity or certainly the truth. Yet, when you sacrifice integrity and the truth in the cause of concealing defeat, you lose much more than a war or two. You lose honor, in the long run, an unsustainable price for any military to pay. Or rather, it should be unsustainable, yet the American people have continued to support their military both by funding it astronomically and expressing seemingly eternal confidence in it, though. After all these years, trust in the military has dipped somewhat recently. Still, in all this time, no one in the senior ranks, civilian or military, has ever truly been called to account for losing wars prolonged by self-serving lies. In fact, too many of U.S. losing generals have gone right through that infamous revolving door into the industrial part of the military-industrial complex, only to sometimes return to take top government positions. The U.S. military has in fact developed a narrative that's proven remarkably effective in insulating it from accountability. It goes something like this. U.S. troops fought hard and put the name of the country here, so don't blame them. Indeed, you must support them, especially given all the casualties of the U.S. wars around the globe. They and the generals did their best under the usual political constraints. That's what they say. On occasion, mistakes were made, but the military and the U.S. government had good and honorable intentions in Vietnam, Afghanistan, Iraq, and elsewhere, they claim. The reality of it all, however, is so much harsher than that. U.S. senior military leaders have performed very weak and poorly. War crimes have been covered up. Wars fought in the name of helping others have produced horrendous civilian casualties and a stunning numerous of refugees. Even at those wars were being lost, what President Dwight D. Eisenhower first labeled the military-industrial complex has enjoyed windfall profits and expanding power. Again, there has been no accountability for failure. In fact, only whistleblowing truth-tellers like Chelsea Manning and Daniel Hale have been punished and jailed. The website of the American Conservative wrote, "The leaders and most of the news media in the U.S. seem to believe that Washington's foreign policy over the past several decades has been a success and benefited both the U.S. and the world. That assumption wasn't really true, even during the Cold War, although that confrontation eventually resulted in the demise of America's nasty totalitarian adversary. There was plenty of collateral damage along the way, with the suffering caused by Washington's conduct in Vietnam and Afghanistan being the most glaring examples. The performance of U.S. leaders after the Cold War has been even worse. An array of disruptive, bloody tragedies, most notably those in the Balkans, Afghanistan, Iraq, Libya, Syria, and Yemen, mark Uncle Sam's global trail of wreckage. The Biden administration's decision to use Ukraine as a pawn in Washington's power struggle with Russia is fast becoming the latest example. Very few policymakers even concede that Washington's overseas military adventures often have not turned out as planned. The news media, which is supposed to serve as the public's watchdog, have routinely ignored or excused America's foreign policy disasters. Instead, when one intervention fails, they simply move on to lobby for the next crusade pushed by U.S. leaders. The American conservative added, "Consider how few news accounts now deal with the ongoing violence and chaos in places such as Libya, Syria, and Yemen, even though Washington was a major contributor to all of those tragedies." Paul Post, a scholar with the Chicago Council on Global Affairs, aptly describes the conflict in Syria as America's forgotten war. That the war in Syria has become the forgotten war, he observes, points to a more disturbing trend in U.S. foreign policy. The United States is so engaged in wars and interventions around the world that the conflict involving the U.S. military that has killed hundreds of thousands of civilians does not even register with the American public anymore. The website of the American Conservative wrote, "Despite the extensive human suffering caused by Washington's long war in Afghanistan, that episode is already fading in prominence now that U.S. troops are no longer in the country. Ukraine is the new center of attention, and the conflict there is portrayed in the same simplistic, melodramatic fashion that has characterized Washington's previous crusades." The elite's post-Cold War track record is not a pretty one. Even the cases touted as successes fail to stand up to scrutiny. Interventionists emphasize that NATO's use of military force ended both Bosnia's civil war and fighting in Kosovo. Although that can be considered a success, it is a partial one at best. Despite the passage of 27 years, Bosnia is no closer to being a viable united country today than it was in the mid-1990s. The three antagonistic ethnic groups still refuse to cooperate, and the Serbs even periodically threaten to secede. By all measures, Bosnia is utterly dysfunctional both economically and politically. Indeed, NATO's military intervention merely may have postponed the day of reckoning. Matters are even worse following the U.S. crusades in other countries. In Syria, for example, Washington continues to support separatists in northeastern Syria and has effective control over that area's oil production. The country, though, may be shattered beyond repair from the years of fighting facilitated by the U.S. regime leaders. The level of human tragedy in Libya and Yemen is horrifying. Washington and its NATO allies bear almost exclusive responsibility for the situation in Libya. U.S. and NATO airstrikes played a decisive role in overthrowing Libyan leader Muammar Gaddafi in 2011. Libya thereafter became an arena of chaos as a multitude of militias vied for power, displacing more than a million residents. There were even credible reports of open-air slave markets for immigrants from sub-Saharan Africa. In the past few years, the fighting has coalesced it into a contest for political dominance between a government that the U.S. supports and an insurgent army led by Field Marshal Khalifa Haftar, who was once a CIA asset. Scheduled national elections have been postponed numerous times, and fighting continues to periodically erupt. Washington also bears less direct but still significant responsibility for the suffering in Yemen. The Obama, Trump, and Biden administrations have all supported the war of aggression that Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, and their Persian Gulf allies have waged against the people. The result has been appalling suffering by civilians, including widespread disease and famine conditions. The latest application of Washington's meddlesome policy is in Ukraine. U.S. leaders ignored repeated warnings that making Ukraine a NATO member or even an unofficial NATO military asset would cross a line that threatened Russia's security. When Moscow finally responded to the provocations with a conflict to Ukraine in February 2022, the Biden administration opted to use Ukraine as a Western proxy war against Russia. The conflict has already done enormous damage to the infrastructure of both countries. Worse, Washington and London appear to have sabotaged the possible peace accord between Moscow and Kiev. The U.S. foreign policy record over the past three decades could hardly be worse. It is crucial not to let policymakers and their media mouthpieces get away with convenient collective amnesia and imitations of Pontius Pilate. Instead, they need to be held fully accountable for their blunders and deception. Future U.S. policymakers also need to avoid repeating the faulty performance of their predecessors. To do so, they must make three significant changes to U.S. foreign policy. First, Washington should utterly renounce nation-building, trying to remake alien societies by force and impose Western political, economic, and social values is the essence of folly. Even when the United States has not yet been drawn into a new war to enforce crumbling nation-building goals, as in Bosnia and Kosovo, such armed social experiments are an exercise in futility and frustration. Worse, nation-building missions frequently worsen conditions in the targeted country. And the predictable failure of U.S. objectives even can lead to Washington's outright humiliation. The debacle in Afghanistan is a stark reminder of that danger. Second, the United States must avoid the temptation to engage in regime change wars. Such offensives often are a prelude to disastrous nation-building ventures. Third, the U.S. leaders must do a much better job of distinguishing vital national interests from secondary or peripheral ones. Washington's current policy of using Ukraine as a proxy for a war against Russia is a troubling example of the failure to make such basic distinctions. The Biden administration is risking nuclear war with Russia to assist a corrupt authoritarian regime in a country of little importance to the United States. Until early 1990s, Ukraine wasn't even an independent country, much less a U.S. vital interest. To accept the risks of Biden administration is incurring is irresponsible and violates the U.S. government's responsibility to the American people.
Here's a look at our top stories. This hour, two Iranian intelligence organizations say undeniable evidence shows